Eventually, the Seleucid Empire dominated the northern and eastern regions, and the Ptolemies dominated the west and the south of Egypt. The Antigonids ruled Macedonia. The republics of Rome and Carthage loomed on the horizon as a shadow of increasing danger. But for now, the Seleucid kingdom's greatest concern was with the expanding reach of the Ptolemies in the land of Palestine. This marriage to Laodice would create diplomatic ties with Pontus in the north, and with it, an ally against the encroaching Ptolemaic interests from the south. Power could not be achieved or maintained without politics. The king's most trusted advisor and prime minister, Hermias, stood beside him like a bird of prey on the arm of a falconer. This grizzled war veteran and ruthless advisor had recently forced another general, Epigenes, into retirement. They had given contrasting advice to the king regarding the rebel Molon, the governor general of Media. Molon was leading a revolt against Antiochus. Epigenes had counseled the king to inspire his forces by personally leading them in battle against Molon. Hermias counseled the king to stay out of the fight and lead from a safe distance. His life was too valuable to risk out on the field of battle. But because the treasury was so low, Hermias promised to personally pay for the battle if the king led from behind the forces and Epigenes retired to his hometown. Antiochus followed the former's advice. Hermias was a brilliant strategist on and off the battlefield. As protective as Hermias appeared to be, Xeniatus knew he still sought personal gain. But his loyalty to the throne had been consistent. His war-scarred body and face illustrated his willingness to die for the Seleucid cause. Xeniatus knew the king respected Hermias for his ability to maneuver his personal interests in subjection to his support for the crown. All men sought power. Those who pretended not to were the ones most suspicious to the king. Xeniatus didn't trust any of the generals. But then again, Xeniatus wasn't exactly the most trustworthy of subjects either. He had a secret of his own, something he wanted to prove to the king. The musicians began playing flute, lyre, and harp as all eyes turned to look for the arriving queen in waiting. But Xeniatus kept his gaze upon the king, who now stood to receive his bride. Xeniatus looked with envy upon the man that he felt he knew better than the sycophants and plotters around him did. He could see the pain in the king's eyes. Though the people treated their kings as gods, Xeniatus knew Antiochus was very human. Previous Seleucid kings had taken epithets to distinguish themselves with increasing self-aggrandizement. The first Seleucus dubbed himself Seleucus Victor. His son called himself Antiochus Savior. His son became Antiochus God. Antiochus the Great took his title from Alexander, his more human yet no less imperious example of power and vainglory. But Xeniatus knew the king's secret. He knew why this man could never be satisfied with all the power in the world. Antiochus the king stared down the long pillared approach to the throne. The future queen now stood in the entrance, dressed in dazzling display of the finest Greek adornment. A white dress, augmented by gold and turquoise jewelry. Mediterranean cosmetics on perfectly pale skin, made soft with honey and perfumed with herbal ointments. A translucent veil covered her braided hair, her darkened eyes enticing. She was a goddess. She glided slowly past the crowd on her way to the throne, where king and priest stood waiting to officiate the holy matrimony. Yet Antiochus did not see her. His thoughts drifted away to the painful memories of his haunted past. This woman, Laodice, this royal queen-to-be, was a politically important alliance. She was even a spectacle of poise and beauty. But she was not Thera.